Did you know that women who eat more sugar during pregnancy are more likely to have children who eat more sugar throughout their lives? Now, this raises the question, are we conditioned at birth to actually be addicted to sugar? And let's face it, we're all born into a sugar-laden world that sets us up to really be hooked on processed foods and sugar. And this may even start in vitro. But how did we actually get here? And more importantly, what the heck do we do about it? Well, today's interview with Dr. Nicole Avena is eye-opening. We talk about why sugar is so prevalent in our society and the effects of a high sugar diet pre, during, and after pregnancy on our ability to develop as human beings in a world that is so laden with processed foods. So this is a powerful conversation, and we talk about so much more about how we can actually get back in control and Dr. Nicole Avena's amazing approach to baby stepping our way into reducing the sugar in our lives and really why we're all addicted to it in the first place. So without further ado, let's play that episode right now. And I hope that you enjoy everything that we talk about today with Dr. Nicole Avena. Welcome to the Beyond Sugar Freedom Podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Dame, sugar freedom expert and somatic embodiment coach. Together, we'll be diving into much more than just another conversation around sugar addiction and nutrition. But more importantly, I'll be guiding you through the inner work, mindset shifts, and emotional healing that ultimately lies at the root of your unhealthy habits with food. Are you ready? Let's dive in. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode here on the Beyond Sugar Freedom Podcast. So excited today being joined by Dr. Nicole Avena, and we're going to dive into some amazing conversations today. But before we do, just a little bit about Dr. Nicole Avena. She is an associate professor of neuroscience at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City and a visiting professor of health psychology at Princeton University. She is a research neuroscientist and an expert in the fields of nutrition, diet, and addiction, with a special focus on nutrition during early life and pregnancy and women's health. In addition to over 100 peer-reviewed scholarly publications, Dr. Avena has also written several popular books, including Why Diets Fail Because You're Addicted to Sugar, What to Eat When You're Pregnant, What to Feed Your Baby and Toddler, and What to Eat When You Want to Get Pregnant. And most excitingly, her latest book, Sugarless, covers the latest science on sugar addiction and how to overcome it. She is also frequently appears as a science expert in the media, including regular appearances on Good Day New York, The Doctors, and the former Dr. Oz show. Her work has been featured in Time Magazine, Bloomberg Businessweek, The New York Times, and many others. So, with obviously, Dr. Nicole knows a lot about sugar, and we're so grateful to have you here today. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm happy to talk with you today.
Yeah, so looking forward to picking your brain. I mean, obviously, listeners here of the show are well-versed in, you know, sugar being a problem in their lives. And I'm looking forward to the lens that you bring. And obviously, you've spent many years studying addiction and focusing on food. So we're going to get into that. But before we do, I'd love to just invite you to share a little bit about your story. You know, what is it that got you into the work that you're doing today? What's your journey with sugar? I love kind of pulling that out if you have one. And we'll kind of start from there.
Yeah, no, great place to start. So my journey here has been, I guess, a little different perhaps than probably the majority of your listeners. And so I was lucky that I never personally struggled with sugar in terms of my diet. Now, that's not to say I wasn't, you know, exposed to it. I mean, I actually grew up in a house, you know, I'm a kid of the 80s. So we had sugar everywhere. We had soda, we had candies, cakes. I mean, it was like, you know, just my parents didn't really pay much attention or weren't aware of the dangers of it. And so I kind of grew up with a lot of sugar, and I just got turned off, I think, by it, to be quite honest. And when I went to college, I started to see how, you know, you don't have to eat like that. And there's other, you know, opportunities to eat different cuisine. And I got exposed to, you know, different cultural foods. And one of the things that I also got interested in was the brain. And I went on to go to graduate school at Princeton, and I was looking at a neuroscience laboratory and working in a neuroscience laboratory for my PhD. And we started to talk about what I might do for my dissertation, which is this like big, long 5-year project. And one of the things that we were talking about at the time, my advisor and I, was the fact that, you know, obesity rates are going up and people still think obesity is a moral failing and that people just don't have willpower. But if you look at our food environment, I mean, it's changed so much. We have so much sugar, so much processed food. And so we started to wonder, well, maybe people are getting addicted to sugar and these processed foods, just like people could get addicted to alcohol or to drugs. And so at the time, that was kind of a wacky idea because this is like 20 years ago. And, you know, people were still really only thinking about addiction as something that was specific to drugs or alcohol, not anything else. And so we started to do a bunch of experiments to see, okay, well, does sugar meet the criteria for being an addictive substance? And so basically, to make a long story short, that's how I got here. So, you know, we've published over 100 papers in scholarly journals looking at this. And at the end of the day, what we've been able to show is that, yes, sugar meets the criteria for being an addictive substance. And, you know, I'm still doing this work and researching it. And it's just really been an interesting journey to get this far and to get to where we are now.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So what makes, what is the criteria for an addictive substance? Like, I think that would be really interesting. What are the criteria that sugar is meeting here?
Yeah. So what we've used are the criteria that the American Psychiatric Association puts forth in their guidelines for practitioners. And they have a book that's called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders. And in its fifth iteration, its fifth version, they list the criteria for substance use disorder. And so, you know, these are different things. They're, you know, like, for example, using more of the substance than you intend to, or having, you know, a desire to quit or limit your intake, but not being able to, or, you know, giving up social, you know, activities so that you can use the substance, withdrawal, tolerance. So there's a variety of different criteria, and you don't need to meet all of them. There's actually a spectrum now of meeting a diagnosis. So you could have a mild substance use disorder, or you can have a more severe form, and you could be somewhere in the middle too, depending on how many criteria you meet. So yeah, I mean, we've been able to just basically systematically take these different criteria and ask a bunch of empirical questions and do studies to say, okay, can sugar do that? Does that happen with sugar? And, you know, by and large, aside from the ones that are social constructs, like, for example, you know, you don't have to give up your job to use sugar, right? But you do if you maybe are addicted to heroin, because you just, that's just, you can't go to work and do your heroin. So again, some of these are somewhat socially constructed, depending on whether or not a drug is legal or not, or a substance, I should say, is legal or not, or socially accepted. But yeah, when we look at sugar, you know, those criteria are all met when sugar is the substance of abuse.
Yeah. Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So what in your definition is sugar addiction then? Like, what, you know, even that word addiction, I know many people have different definitions of that. I'd be curious of yours.
Yeah, I think my definition of addiction is evolving as I do more and more research in this area, because, you know, the reality is now that we're learning that a lot of things can be, you know, quote unquote addictive, that means that it's becoming an umbrella term. And we need to really just understand, like, you know, what is the difference between something being addictive and is that causing us harm? Like, for example, you know, someone might say, oh, I'm addicted to, you know, watching Netflix, right? They use the term pretty liberally. But, you know, if you're just watching it at night to calm yourself down or to relax, okay, does that harm anybody? But I mean, if you're, you know, staying home all day and, you know, not eating because you'd rather watch shows, then that's a different story. So I think that when we think about addiction, we need to consider the harm piece in it. And I think that's where sugar is important, because we know now about the significant harm that sugar can do to our health. It's not even just our physical health, but it's our mental health. And the amounts of sugar that people are consuming is so much linked to a lot of the health complications that people are coping with. And so I think that, you know, where we are in the field of defining addictions, I think it really depends on, you know, the harm at one, and two, you know, when we look at all these things that are habit forming and rewarding, you know, we have to be careful about labeling something as addictive. But I think for sure, if we are going to use that term, sugar is going to apply.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think that's really important, pulling out that harm piece, right? I know it, for me, addiction is something that is an activity or a substance that we engage in that we know is causing us harm, but we can't seem to stop. You know, it's kind of a simplified version, right? But it is that harm piece. And I really appreciate bringing in the Netflix there, because there have been many times where I've said that, like, oh, I'm addicted to Netflix. And I know for myself, the coping, escaping mechanisms that are there under my addictive patterns, that yes, sometimes Netflix is filling that. And that's where I use that term. But I think, yeah, that's really important. Like, am I not going to work all day and just binging on Netflix? Like, is it, like, what is the level? And I guess everybody's going to kind of have a different definition of level of harm, right? Because there's physical harm, mental harm, spiritual harm, emotional harm, right? Like, there's so many different ways, right? If we're engaged in, you know, addictive to shopping, right? I mean, that could cause harm financially, right? So there's a lot of different ways we can decipher that. But of course, with sugar, I think everybody who's listening to this podcast now knows how harmful sugar is physically and mentally. I think we're speaking to that crowd. So I'm curious, why do you think sugar is so pervasive right now? Like, what happened? Where did we go wrong? You know, why is sugar so hard to avoid? I know a lot of my clients come work with me and it's impossible to avoid, right? Sugar is everywhere. That's a common belief that I come up against. So why do you think that is? You know, what's going on here?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I think that things just got out of control. I think that, you know, if you think back to Victorian era, right? I mean, people would have sugar very rarely. It was like a delicacy. You'd break it out at, you know, the holidays, and it was something that we didn't have a lot of access to in terms of added sugar. And then with the ability for us to, you know, industrialize our food sources and mass produce food and the development of processed foods and ultra processed foods, you know, we started to see this introduction of sugar as a way to, you know, make the foods more palatable, as a way to just, you know, increase the taste and the pleasure that people get from the food. And I think that that was fine, but at some point it just got out of control. And now, you know, we see just a ridiculous amount of added sugar in so many of the products that are available. And I think that in general, like, people aren't taking it seriously in terms of why this is dangerous, in terms of, you know, why we need to work, you know, to make our kids not be over consuming sugar so much. Because it's sort of like smoking cigarettes, in the sense that you don't drop dead from smoking one cigarette, just like you don't drop dead from eating a cookie. You die from the health-related complications that emerge slowly over time. And that's what happens with sugar. And so it's really a silent killer. And, you know, to tell somebody who's, you know, 20 years old, like, hey, you know, you're eating all of these foods, it's not going to be good for your health when you're 50. You know, that's not really what people are worried about when they're in their 20s. They're worried about what's going to happen when they're 21, not, you know, what's going to happen 20 or 30 years later. So because the ill effects of sugar often take years to manifest, then we see that people just, you know, don't necessarily equate the danger to our consumption of it. And I think that's really the biggest challenge. And in terms of, you know, the hidden sugars, I mean, it's just pervasive. And so many people, even if they're thinking they're eating a healthy diet, they're just often not, because they're just unaware of all the places that sugar can be finding its way into their food.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. That's often the first exercise I have my clients do, is go track your sugar for a week. And they're just shocked, like, where sugar is, right? It's in my salad dressing. And Even, yeah, it's just, it's wild when we start looking, right, and understanding.
It is. Yeah, it's one of the things in my new book, Sugar List, that I have people do is to really, you know, systematically take a hard look at what you're eating and the types of foods that you like and the things you drink and write them down. And, you know, really, when you get down into the weeds and you see what these ingredients are, you know, it's very, very easy to have more than the recommended amount of sugar each day before you even leave your house, before you even get out of your pajamas. So I think that most people are largely unaware because, you know, marketing has normalized it, right? You know, when we have like these breakfast cereals that are marketed towards kids, or even when we have things that look to be healthier, like yogurts and, you know, breakfast sandwiches and things that don't necessarily even have a sweet taste to them, when you look down at the details, they have a ton of sugar. And so even if you're not eating a diet that seems like it's overly sweet, odds are there's sugar in most of the foods that you're eating.
Yeah. And that's really important to pull out. I think a lot of people, I see that too, right? Think, well, I don't snack, or I'm not eating dessert. Right. And like, lo and behold, it's sneaking into, like you said, the breakfast sandwich, the yogurt and granola, that healthy vitamin water that you had, right? All those drinks. So right. What would you say then, you know, I know, this can be tricky, right? In a world where it seems to be everywhere, right? It seems to be, you know, in a lot of food, and they're using, you know, almost like 200 or 300 different names for sugar now, right? In packages. How do people start to manage? Like, how do we, those of us who don't want to be, you know, eating all this sugar and want to start tapering off, like, how do we navigate that then? Like, how do we begin to take ourselves out of this sugar-centric sort of society that we live in?
Well, you know, one of the things that I really advocate is taking a smaller baby step approach. And the reason for this is because I think over the years, people have tried and tried again to do these cold turkey, you know, cut it all out overnight approaches. And I'm not saying they don't work. I'm saying they can work for people who are extremely diligent and who are able to do it that way. But I think the majority of people find that when they try to do something that's a cold turkey, all or nothing approach, if they have a setback, or if they, you know, end up eating something with a ton of sugar in it and they just have a moment where they give in, then they feel this sense of guilt and shame. And I think that a more sustainable approach is to systematically work through your diet and get the sugar out that way. And so this is, I think, easier because it's a bunch of small decisions, right? And so, for example, let's just say you're starting with your coffee, which is a place I actually recommend to start with your beverages, because the beverages are a huge source of added sugar for a lot of people. And so if you're a coffee drinker, and let's just say, you know, usually you put some sugar in your coffee, or you have one of those fancy creamers that you like to put in, all right, well, maybe you're going to put less of it. Right. It's not about just, oh, now I have to drink my coffee with nothing in it, but maybe you're going to start off with less. Or, you know, maybe you're going to identify, like, you know, a milk that doesn't have any added sugar that you like, that you could add to lighten up your coffee. And so what can you do to just make a change in just one thing, and that be your new norm? And I think that when people do that, it's less overwhelming, it's more approachable, and it's something that you can actually stick to. So that's really where I think the strategy lies, is in, you know, systematically making these small changes, because they're going to add up over time, and they are going to be easier to manage and stick with.
Yeah, I love that. I'm as you're talking, I'm thinking of how I did that. I'm like thinking way back to years ago. I did that same thing with coffee. I used to drink like the Starbucks caramel macchiatos, like loaded with sugar. And then I started tapering off. And now when I have coffee, it's just with cow's milk, you know, and I don't add anything. Or my homemade almond milk. That's another thing. Like, I make my own almond milk now, and it used to be weird. And now it's just what I do. Salad dressing.
Yeah. Right?
Like, I can't remember the last time I bought a salad dressing. Like, it's just become part of like what I do. Like, oh, I'm out of salad dressing, I'll just make more. It's not this big thing. And over time, like you said, all those changes really start to add up. And I love that. I want to add, you know, to that as well, like the cold turkey sort of versus like slowly tapering off, I think psychologically, you already sort of mentioned this, right, is one of the biggest pieces around that. For so many, I know my clients, sugar is like their only source of joy. It's their only source of like happiness or like this friend, right? And ripping that off without actually having a bit of a foundation to support yourself with some of those things that sugar was masking, you know, whether it was an escapism or a tool, right? With addiction, it's a tool to escape something. So I think that tapering off, I'll echo that. That's something that I do with my clients as well. I think it's a lot more physically supportive and also mentally and emotionally supported as we start to gain our confidence and our sense of self without sugar.
Yes. Yes, I completely agree. And I think a lot of times, you know, people don't always like to admit it. And I don't think they always realize it right away, but they're using sugar to help regulate their emotions, to help manage their anxiety, to help alleviate, you know, feeling a little sad or low. Or they're using sugar, and I don't know if you've encountered this with your patients, but I've seen this quite a bit where people are using sugar to tell themselves that they did a good job. It's like a way to, you know, reward yourself for whatever it might be. And sometimes it's just to reward yourself for getting through the day. And so I think that, you know, when we are able to kind of step away from that and really see that, wow, you know, so much of my emotional investment here is tied to this stuff that I'm consuming, then, you know, you really, really are able to kind of view it as something like, okay, well, maybe I need to think about like, if I'm having sugar, or I just feel this urge to, you know, create a craving for sugar, like after dinner, you know, is it because there's a lot of chaos in your house? You're trying to clean up the dishes. The kids need help with homework. Like, what's going on that's sort of like promoting that? And if it is something that, you know, you can change and control, then that's a better way to do it as opposed to just, you know, putting some sugar on top and using it as a Band-Aid.
Yeah, for sure. It is a Band-Aid. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I mean, that's really all we talk about on this podcast is the deeper rooted pieces. So this is fantastic. So everyone's well-versed in that, like the deeper, the emotional pieces and the trauma and the reasons why, you know, we engage in addictive behaviors. So I'm curious, you know, we might have already covered this, but I'm curious if you have anything else to add to this around, you know, your thoughts on why we are so addicted to sugar. Is it just because it's everywhere, you know, or are there other pieces that you've seen?
Well, I think it's partly the availability. I mean, it's like other addictive substances. I mean, if there was, you know, morphine hidden in our food and, you know, morphine in all the coffee shops and the coffee beverages, we'd all be addicted to morphine. I mean, that's just the way it works. So, you know, the more often you're consuming an addictive substance, the more likely you are to get addicted to it. And I think that, you know, there's that piece of it. There's the availability piece. There's also, you know, the normalization of it socially. I mean, I have little kids and I see this all the time with even at their school. I mean, it's just overly promoted that, oh, it's, you know, sweets and treats and, you know, all day long. And it's not like it's somebody's birthday. I'm all for people celebrating their birthday. And if the kids want to bring in cupcakes, that's great. But, you know, it's gotten to the point where, you know, our kids are getting rewarded just for behaving, like, which they're supposed to do anyway, you know, with a cupcake or with like cookies or lollipops. And so I think that it's being utilized as a reward and a reinforcer in a way that, you know, I don't know is really helping. And then I also think this, the amounts. So, you know, it's not like we have a little bit of sugar here and there. It's the amounts of these individual products. You know, can you imagine we're consuming this bolus of sugar in a very short amount of time? And so we know from, you know, drug addiction research that if you take a large amount of a drug, it's going to affect your brain in a way that's going to release a large amount of dopamine. It's going to have an effect on their endogenous opioid system. And so I think that is changing the neurochemistry. That's changing our brain. And that is what's really promoting this addiction spiral that a lot of people get themselves in. You know, it'd be one thing if we had a couple of grains of sugar sprinkled throughout the day, right? Or here and there. But we're talking about going from one sugar binge to the next. And it's not because people are actually binge eating. It's because they're having these processed foods that have so much added sugar in them that it almost looks like a binge. And our brains think we're binging because of that amount of sugar that we're getting at one time. So I think that part of it is important too in propagating the brain systems that are responsible for addiction.
Yeah, 100%. You know, I often talk about that. We've been overdosing on sugar our whole lives, right? And for most of us, without even knowing it. You know, I didn't know it. Right? It was just kind of what we did growing up, right? And there was nothing wrong with the fact that I ate sugar cubes every day, right? Like just wild. I look back now. Oh gosh, how did I make it through? But I think we all have that, you know, and this is a societal shift that we're making as we learn and educate, and people like you doing such amazing work in promoting and educating, right, the world on the dangers.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned about the dangers and about the sugar cubes, because I distinctly recall being, you know, I grew up in the 1980s. And so like the big fear back then was that if you eat too much sugar, you're going to get cavities.
Right.
And that was literally all anybody talked about when it came to sugar in terms of worrying was, oh, you don't want to get a cavity. You don't want to get a cavity. And I think it's so much more than cavities. And now we know that. Now it's like, you know, you don't want to get heart disease. You don't want to get, you know, diabetes. You don't want to get all these other things. You don't want to, you know, have it contribute to your low mood, which, you know, could be promoting your anxiety and depression. So there's so many effects now. And I'm not sure if we've caught up with that. Like, I don't know if, you know, that's really being talked about enough to people at a younger age. And not that we want to scare anybody, but that's the reality. I mean, just like, you know, we were scared as kids that we were going to get cavities. You know, I think kids need to get a little scared of the fact that, hey, if you eat too much sugar, you're going to end up diabetic by the time you're 12 years old.
Yeah.
Because it's a reality.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you say that, because I'm thinking of a conversation I had with my niece. She must have been like 4. Didn't understand anything, but I taught her then if she eats too much sugar, she'll get diabetes. And to this day, this was like years ago, she still says it back to me. She doesn't quite understand what it means, but I, you know, and I didn't do that in necessarily the best educating way. It was more of a joke, but it stuck with her. And now maybe she will learn what diabetes is and she doesn't want it. But there, yeah, I think that's a really beautiful point there, is bringing this conversation in more to a way that can relate to kids, right? Because they're not going to know what cancer is or diabetes or heart disease is, but they sure know maybe the pain of a toothache or of being tired all day or feeling gross in their tummy, right? Or starting to connect these things for them.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's not, you know, obviously not all diabetes is directly linked to sugar intake, but we know that, you know, you're at greater risk for developing lots of health complications the more added sugar you're eating. And I think that if we can do something to, you know, really kind of bring this awareness to people about these health dangers linked to sugar, then I think it could have an effect. Like, look what happened with other things, like smoking cigarettes, for example, tobacco. I mean, when it became clear that, it causes lung cancer, it's, you know, causing heart disease, it's causing you to have all of these health complications, you know, people started to then make some changes, but that wasn't really enough. I mean, that's the issue. And I teach a health psychology course here at Princeton, and, you know, I'm talking actually in the lecture now about smoking and the history of tobacco use in the United States. And, you know, the warnings were a little helpful, but it wasn't until we started to see, you know, bans on advertisements and, you know, actual like programs that were put in place to get kids to not start smoking, and lawsuits that were, you know, filed against the tobacco companies, you know, because of this. And so I think we have a bit of a road to go down, and I don't think it's going to end at just telling people like, sugar's bad for your health. We're going to have to do more than that.
Especially when it's an addiction, right? We know that know that it's not good for our health, right? But we can't stop it. And that's where the addiction comes in, right? And there's so many other layers to it. But yeah, I totally agree. I'm thinking like how much of that is socially acceptable, right? Like as soon as sugar is no longer socially acceptable and you're the weird one eating cake at the party, like that's going to be a big player, right? When I think of smoking, right? Like I don't know anybody who smokes. And if somebody's smoking, I kind of am like, get away from me. Like you're weird, right? Like I think that social piece I don't know if we'll ever get there, but I could see that being such a massive part of it, right? And same with drinking, right? Like, is that starting to become less of this like awesome thing to do, at least in my networks, of course?
yes.
We're starting to see the ones being healthy is cool, right? Maybe being healthy needs to be cool.
Yeah, I know. It is, I think you're right in that over time, I feel like, you know, the things that were popular generationally for people to indulge themselves in to alleviate stress, to self-medicate. I mean, if you think about it, like, you know, back in the 1960s, you know, we didn't have internet. So we didn't have Netflix, you know, you didn't have all these other outlets. And, you know, so people smoked. Yeah. People drank because that was pretty much all you had, right? And so now that we have these, you know, sugar then came on the scene, right? We started seeing more and more sugar in our diet. And it's interesting, if you look at the smoking rates, as smoking went down, sugar intake went up and obesity rates went up. And so, you know, it's been argued that, and I kind of think this is the case, that, you know, yeah, we may have reduced our dependence on smoking and saved lives, but we've introduced a new dependence on sugar and we are costing more lives. And, you know, so we're fighting the same fight just all over again in a different generation, and it's starting over. And then I often wonder, you know, because I have, you know, little kids myself, I have a teenager. I also, you know, teach college students. So I feel like I have a pretty good pulse on like what everyone's thinking these days at the different generational levels below me, that, you know, now the internet's here. And, you know, so that's advice for people where, you know, that's a way to, you know, in some way self-soothe or, you know, just, I don't know. So we don't know. We don't know what the effects of that are going to be. And so it will be interesting to see, like, yeah, if smoking gets faded out, if alcohol gets faded out, that's great. But is it going to get replaced with stuff that's just as damaging? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Sugar is. I think sugar is one of the replacements, and it's certainly just as damaging.
Yeah. And I think technology and social media is too. I'm going to be bold and say that. Like, I think that's, you're absolutely onto something there with how we do replace one addiction with another unless we actually deal with the root cause, unless we actually get in systemically to not needing to self-soothe or cope or numb out or escape. And that's a whole nother rabbit hole. But I want to take a slight little turn here with you, because I know that you are an expert for moms when, like, getting pregnant, during pregnancy, after pregnancy with their kids. And I'm curious, often even thinking back to my sugar addiction and like coming out of the womb addicted to sugar, I often say my mom was very addicted to sugar, you know, runs in the family, that pattern of using sugar to go through the day. And I'm wondering, like, maybe you can speak to sort of each phase. Like, what are the effects of, for instance, a mom who's pregnant eating a ton of sugar? Like, what does that actually do to the fetus? And then maybe as she breastfeeds, and then the effects on younger years of like this. Cause I mean, that was me. I had a lot of sugar pumped into me when I was in the womb and after the womb and all through my childhood. And I'm curious, like, what are you seeing the effects there, both, you know, physically, mentally, emotionally, and all those pieces?
Yeah, you know, I've been really interested in the developmental aspect of this. And so I've written a couple of books related to, you know, sugar and food in general, just nutrition during different stages of development. So preconception, fertility, how it can affect, you know, pregnancy and then those early years of life, those first 1,000 days of life, pregnancy through age 2. And, you know, one of the things that I've really been able to see through the research, that some of which we've done, but largely what a lot of others have been doing, is that, you know, what you eat early in life can have a long-term impact on health outcomes big time. And, you know, not only is it basically setting the stage for food preferences and, you know, the agreeableness that you are going to have when introduced to these different tastings later on, but it also has a significant role in our immune system health. You know, eating the right diet early in life, and that's in utero or, you know, even before, it can have an impact on cognitive development. I mean, there's so many things that nutrition early in life is linked to. And I think for the longest time, the research had focused on undernutrition or malnutrition, like cases where, you know, women were living in situations of poverty where they didn't have enough food. And so they were basically, you know, very underweight and not getting enough nutrients to support a healthy pregnancy. And what were the health outcomes of the offspring in those situations? But now we're seeing, you know, yes, unfortunately, we still deal with undernutrition in certain parts of the world, but most of the world's dealing with overnutrition, meaning obesity. And you can still be malnourished and be struggling with obesity. Yeah. And so there are many people who fill that category because many of the highly processed foods that people are overeating are rich in calories and they're rich in fat and they're rich in, you know, sugars, but they're not rich in a lot of the other nutrients that we need to stay healthy. And so that's where we can become malnourished in many different ways. And so I think it's important that, you know, we are aware of that because, you know, knowing that the average woman enters a pregnancy either overweight or obese, so meaning that they're already not perhaps having the healthiest diet to begin with, that basically means we're just, you know, starting off a little bit behind, right, in terms of optimizing nutrition. So I do think it's something that, again, we really need to put more efforts into educating people about. I mean, I've had two babies myself, so I can speak from experience that, you know, if you go to the doctor in the US when you're pregnant, they don't ask you what kinds of food you're eating. All they do is weigh you to make sure you've gained a certain amount of weight or not. And then, you know, that's it. And then you, the only other time nutrition comes up is if you develop gestational diabetes and then, you know, you get guidance on what to eat to deal with that. But by and large, I mean, you know, my OBGYN never asked me like, what do I like to eat for breakfast? Yeah. You know, they don't pay attention to that. And again, it's because largely that they're not told in medical school or through the medical guidelines, like, hey, you need to be a nutrition consultant to these patients. But I think we need to change that because we know that there's so much about nutrition that it can have an impact on the health outcomes of the baby and the success of the pregnancy going smoothly. So I just think we could do a lot more based off of the science and, you know, what the current state of knowledge is in these areas.
Yeah, I 100% agree. You know, I'm sitting here thinking as you're talking, right? Like we know socially now, most of us know socially that it's not good to smoke if you're pregnant and it's not good to drink alcohol when you're pregnant, right? And maybe not too much caffeine. I don't know. But here's sugar, right? That is what most people then turn to. You know, I don't have children yet myself. It's a journey my husband and I are just about to embark on. So I'm excited to grab your books and support myself with that. But yeah, it's like, it's just, it's interesting to see how we don't think that through, right? And a lot of people, because we don't have the guidance, and a lot of it has to become, like, I know for me, I need to do my own research because, like you said, my doctor's not going to tell me about that. I don't even have a doctor. Like, they're not going to ask me those questions. I'm going to have to self-educate myself. And a lot of people just don't know, or they don't have the resources to do that, right? Or the time or the money or the know-how that, hey, it, like, I need to actually look into how to grow the healthiest baby, right? You know, that is a tricky piece if it's not being at least talked about. Even just planting a seed, you know, at the doctor's office, most women are not going to pay any attention to it.
Right. And I mean, if you think about it, it is somewhat of a modern day problem in the sense that, you know, my grandmother didn't have to worry about this when she was pregnant because there was a completely different food environment back then. And so, you know, now we're in an environment with all these processed foods and we're basically living in an experiment. Yeah. Of, you know, what's going to happen when you have a pregnant person eating all these, you know, processed foods, all this added sugar, we can't just assume that everything's going to go okay, right? And we know it's not going to go okay. So that's why I think we need to really provide some more support and some more, you know, information. And that's one of the main reasons why I wrote my book, What to Eat When You're Pregnant. I wrote that one initially because when I was pregnant with my first daughter, I was literally shocked by how little nutrition information there was out there. And I thought, you know, oh, I know this stuff. I'm going to be okay in terms of what to eat. But I was thinking boy, if I didn't know what I know and I didn't do this for a living, like, you know, my friends who were pregnant at the same time, everybody was asking me all this information about stuff because all it was very negative, like, oh, don't eat, you know, raw hot dogs, right, and don't eat like deli meat and stuff that was like very, nobody would eat anyway, but like, you know, stuff that wasn't really like very helpful in the sense of, okay, well, how do I, what do I eat? Who cares what I'm not supposed to eat? What about what I should eat? So I think that that's where, you know, we can really make some changes and hopefully, you know, prevent a lot of the issues that we're seeing now from happening in the beginning. Because if we can get our little ones off on a great start in life with nutritious food, get them used to eating those types of things, then they're going to be less inclined to then, you know, have to want to eat them otherwise, you know, eat the junk food and eat the other things when it gets introduced later on.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was just on a podcast interview myself before this, and we were talking about morning routines, and we were talking about how important it is to like start your day grounded, right? Mm-hmm. And this is kind of the same thing. It's like how we start our lives or how we start our days, right, really sets us up for the rest of the day or the rest of our life, right? And, you know, I think it's important to also mention, you know, like for anyone who is a mother like you that might be hearing this and going, oh no, I fucked up. I did not start my kid off right. I ate a ton of sugar when I was pregnant. You know, so I just really want to call that out, that there's no room for guilt or shame or blame here. And there is things we can do. I mean, I'm proof of that. You know, I was just indoctrinated with sugar all through my you know, time in the womb and many, many years after, and my health is okay. You know, I was able to get it back under control. So there's always things we can do. But like you're saying, it really does make a difference if we have a choice. And that's something, you know, I'm grateful to have the knowledge I have as I embark on, you know, my motherhood journey and you know, excited to learn more from you about how we can do that, right? To become, you know, to create, you know, give our children the healthiest chance, especially when it comes to sugar addiction. So are you seeing, I mean, you've kind of said this, I'm curious if you have seen like that direct correlation between like the amount of sugar that a mom is eating while pregnant and the development of an actual like sugar dependency or sugar addiction in the child.
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I'm not aware of any studies in humans that have looked at that. I think that, you know, you have to remember the whole empirical research on sugar addiction, even though sugar addiction's been around for a very long time and lots of people have been struggling with it. Really, our lab was the first to study it, you know, in the academic laboratory, because if you go back, you know, before 2001, oh my gosh, I wish, you know, you wouldn't see any studies on sugar addiction. I mean, it wasn't something that was really being studied. So I think that, you know, when we look at what we know about the human research, I think those studies we're going to have to wait some time to see, right? Because this area of research has really kind of just begun in many ways. But we know from our rat studies, so we've done a lot of human studies, but we've also done a lot of preclinical rat studies. And so, you know, we have done a number of those studies looking at, you know, the effects of sugar during pregnancy. And what we can see is that in our studies, when rats are given a high sugar diet during pregnancy, the babies grow up to want to consume more sugar. Right. They grow up also, interestingly, to be more sensitive to the effects of drugs and alcohol. Yeah. So, again, it goes back to, you know, the fact that during pregnancy, the brain is developing, the reward system is developing. And when it's developing on the background of all the sugar, it's going to develop in a different way than if it were to develop on a background that didn't have all that added sugar. So it does have a change in the brain that occurs that can lead to changes in behavior later on in the future. Now, again, like you just said a few minutes ago, that is not like a be all end all, meaning like if, you know, you were having, you know, a couple cans of soda a day because you were like, you know, sweating during your pregnancy because you were pregnant in August or something, don't worry about it. It's the fact is, you know, knowing that now you can make the changes because our brain's malleable. Our brain, nothing is permanent in our brain in the sense of behaviors, unless there's obviously like an injury, but when we look at changing our behavior, we're always able to make those changes because our brain is so malleable. So I think it's important, like you said, for people who maybe are coming into this with thinking, oh gosh, I was really, you know, had a lot of junk when I was pregnant, or, oh, you know, I let my kid eat all kinds of stuff when they were little that maybe now I'm wishing I hadn't. You know, it doesn't matter. The fact is, you now know what you know, and you can use that information to make, you know, changes moving forward. You can't change the past, but you definitely can direct the future.
Yeah, that's such an important message. Because I know there are a lot of women listening going, oh no, you know, I did it wrong, right? And we're not here to blame or wrong. Exactly. We're here to like learn, and this is how we make change, right? So we can learn and start doing better and then inspire our kids to do better and our grandkids and hopefully pass this on, right? As like just wisdom and knowledge.
Absolutely.
So this has been wonderful. I have so many more questions for you. We'll have to have you back on the show, of course. But I'm curious, as we wrap things up, what are some main takeaways that you would share, you know, for anyone listening that, you know, really wants to get started on this journey? And, you know, what do you see as sort of some first steps for people to start tackling this?
Well, I think one of the main takeaways that I would really say is important, and I talk about this a lot in my book, Sugarless, is that you can make small changes slowly that are going to add up to have really big results. And I think that's really the biggest thing here. It could be so overwhelming for people to hear about, you know, oh, I got to cut back on sugar. It's bad for me, but it's everywhere, but it's hidden, but, you know, it's falling from the sky. I mean, it's a lot. And I think when you try to just think about how you're going to attack that problem, it becomes almost like crippling because you're like, I don't know where to start. Yeah. And so that's really why I think it's important to take small steps, make changes that you can stick to, that you can commit to. And then those changes can get bigger and bigger and bigger over time. You know, if I were to say to you, you know, cut all the sugar out of your diet by tomorrow, all right, yeah, you could do it and it might last a couple days and it's not going to be sustainable. But if I said to you tomorrow, figure out a way to reduce the amount of sugar in your morning coffee. And then the next step is going to be, we're going to reduce the sugar in something else. I mean, those are things you can actually do that are going to have benefits, as opposed to trying to do it all at once and it just not working and you end up going back to just not doing anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, I love that. So helpful, because obviously you're an expert in this area and you've seen that, like the yo-yoing that can show up when we try to go cold turkey, right? The black and white thinking, right? The diet mentality and how that's kind of wreaked havoc on our ability to even like be compassionate with ourselves. So I love that slower approach. We can still engage in society and we don't trigger those parts of us that are like, we can't have something, right? Then we want it more. Like there's a lot of psychological pieces around there. And I love that sort of just going slow and building up. So helpful. So this has been great. Nicole, thank you so much for being here. Where can everybody come and find more about everything that you're doing? Come and buy the book. Obviously, I'll make sure there's some links in the show notes.
Yeah. So thanks so much for having me. It's been so great to talk with you. So the book Sugarless, it's available wherever books are sold. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, the indie bookstores, wherever you go. It's also available in an audiobook, so it's on Audible. And if you want to learn more about me and the work that we're doing, my website's a good resource for that. It's drnicolelevina.com. And then also on social media, you can find me at Dr. Nicole Levina.
Amazing. Yeah, I'll make sure all those links are below. Thank you so much. Really appreciate all the work that you're doing in the world. And of course, taking some time to come and speak to us today here on the podcast, and looking forward to continuing to see what you uncover and what the next book is. More books.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you everyone for tuning in to another episode, and we'll see you on the next one. Thank you for tuning in to another episode. If you're loving what we talked about today, please take a minute to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with someone you love. It helps us in a big way reach more people and change more lives. And if you're ready to go deeper into discovering your unique root causes and patterns that are keeping you hooked on sugar, be sure to check out our brand new free quiz that will tell you which root cause is holding you back from freedom with food and give you the healing action steps to break free from these old patterns for good. Find the link to take the free quiz and other amazing resources in the show notes below.